Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Robert Aberle. Bob is a professor of humanities and philosophy at Diablo Valley College in California. He's authored four books, including Democracy Gone and Anatomy of a Deception. An earlier time when Bob was on, we talked about it. It's about the Iraq invasion, occupation, and preparation for the next deception. There is always another deception, or maybe a better way of putting it is everything that comes out of the mouths of politicians, exclusively always deceptions. Do you expect them to tell the truth? No. Do you expect a beach day in Chicago in January? For sure not today. It's snowing outside. My goodness, first snow of the season. I hope very light. Anyway, I'm staying indoors doing my radio work and doing my writing. And I want to talk with Bob on whatever is on his mind, maybe also his contribution. He's got a new book coming out next year, but he's still working on it. So I'll get him back when that's out, and we'll talk about it. But recently, he contributed seven articles for a new encyclopedia of philosophy, Global Justice. It's coming out in February, and we can talk about that. He's got important topics that he's included in it, including state terrorism, torture, the Geneva Conventions, the kind of stuff you'll never hear about on CNN, that's for sure. Bob, I welcome you. It's been a long time. It's great having you back.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here with you again. I hope you're doing well in the snow.
I'm doing well. I'm sure it's not snowing in Berkeley, is it?
No, it's not. It's actually supposed to rain today, but it's actually okay. Out for a morning walk, it's not really a problem. It's not like the days I lived in Chicago where you couldn't really walk very far when you get into December and January. Unless you're a polar bear, you know, then you can go swimming in January.
Well, I am not a polar bear, that is for sure. There are actually people in Chicago that do go swimming in the lake in the middle of winter, and, well, good luck to them. They claim it's healthy. I would much rather stay inside and stay warm, Bob, and work on the world and national problems that just have me obsessed to stay on all the time.
You never get out the door then, with all the world problems.
I never get out the door. That's right. There's too much going on that keeps me focused inside. But where shall we begin, on your contribution or on current headlines making news? You lead and I'll follow.
Oh, my. There's so many places to begin. It's almost like spinning a roulette wheel that you can always land on seven when you have something to talk about regarding all that's going on. All the big news, of course, that's focused right now is the WikiLeaks, all the leaking that Julian Assange has done and the criticism that he's undergone, the shoot the messenger syndrome, the idea of how dare you challenge corporate government power, let's get rid of him. And all of the claims that were being made in the mainstream media, I still find these claims that I've been reading from the mainstream commentators to be incredulous. I'm incredulous about it. I mean, Jonah Goldberg from the Chicago Tribune calling for the death of Julian Assange. Mark Thiessen of the Washington Post calling on the United States military to take military action against Assange. I would expect all of the stuff from Fox News like that, but the mainstream commentators, I find it very disturbing that that would happen, given what Julian Assange is doing. Now, I take it that some of the mistakes that WikiLeaks has made, and, you know, just throwing all these documents out there, that's fine. They're a brand new organization. They're going into uncharted territory, but the call for their death, that is really extreme, and it seems to me that all we have to do to find the lie there is match it up with what democracy really stands for. And the people like Hillary Clinton and all of these mainstream media commentators who are trying to kill the Assange and WikiLeaks leaks are showing a deep contempt for democracy. The people don't deserve to know this stuff. And so, you know, then I go back to all of the media thing. Why all the media hysteria about this? It's a very important subject. But why are they hysterical? Because it gets in the way of earning profit. So there's all kinds of problems that get hooked up together, and it's all about elites and elite interests and power interests versus what the people have a right to know. Maybe we could just start by unpacking some of that.
Oh, absolutely, Bob. I must say I have my own view on it. Assange, since he's been doing this publicly, of course, he began... he began a number of years ago. I've written a few times about him, and one article that I wrote, it goes back a good number of months now, was citing a Pentagon study that had been following him for a number of years mentioning things of concern, nothing about assassinations, but mentioning things of concern. And then more recently, of course, the thing that really made headlines was when he came out with that video on the turkey shoot in Baghdad, where pilots, like playing a video game, just slaughtering civilians. And there it was. It wasn't just talking about it. You could actually see it. And you could hear these pilots talking about it like kids on a TV screen playing a game. And then, of course, the Afghan war diaries, the Iraq dump that he came out with, and the latest on the cables. But he's been fairly public. He has had public news conferences, including in London. I shake my head and I say, if we wanted to get rid of him, we could have done it a long time ago. The Brits easily could have just arrested him in London on one of his appearances or some other location where he surfaced. So we haven't done it. I can't say for sure. I can't read these people's minds, and I'm certainly not a psychologist, a psychiatrist. But I suspect that they want to beat up on him as part of the fear hysteria campaign here in the country that goes right along with every time there's a headline about someone else plotting an attack on America, whether it's a shoe bomber or a car bomber or an underwear bomber. They're all fake, Bob. They're all fake. But they provoke hysteria. The media headlines just go crazy on them. I've written on case after case after case. I've yet to find a shred of evidence that in a legitimate court would really stand up. It's all concocted. A lot of it has to do with FBI sting operations, the underwear bomber. The guy was set up. The guy literally was set up, and he didn't have a bomb. You go through one case after another. It's the same thing over and over again. But the idea is to stoke fear for the war on terror, to try to justify America's imperial rampaging. And then you go at Assange saying he's jeopardizing national security. He's jeopardizing nothing. Jeopardizing nothing. Some of the stuff that the media reported is so inflammatory in the Afghan war diaries. I wrote about some of that stuff, murdering civilians in Afghanistan, deliberately targeting civilians to kill them willfully, and then calling them militants. I wrote about that. There's a journalist in London. Oh, the Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph, or one of those papers, who's put out a number of reports on this. I quoted him in my article. And so a lot of this stuff is out there, but you never hear about it on CNN or Fox. So I think it's more rhetoric, Bob, than a serious effort to want to get rid of the guy, because I honestly believe if they wanted to do it, he long ago would have been dead or he would be in a prison cell.
I think you're right, and I think he's being used as the new version of Osama bin Laden by the folks in power. And I think it does two things. I think you pointed out something very interesting there, a couple of things. First of all, the idea that Assange is the bad guy and that the reason that we've got to go after this bad guy and also pump up this extra fear with the TSA groping at the airports and stuff, all that works together in the same way. And that is because the United States is losing their economic and military hegemony, because they rely on their economic hegemony in the world to be able to fund their military. It's not just our tax dollars. It's all the borrowing that we're doing from other countries using the dollar as the main currency, the world currency, and that is becoming problematic. And so you've got to hype it up and you've got to ramp it up. If these were really serious fears of terrorism, why aren't we patrolling very heavily shopping centers, shopping malls, and places where the public frequents and hangs out? And why aren't the neocons who brought us all of this nonsense from 9/11, why aren't they being targeted? They don't even have security around them. Condoleezza Rice teaches out here at Stanford. Donald Rumsfeld is out here. John Yoo teaches at Berkeley. And they don't even have their security people around them. But if there was real terrorism around, they would be, I would think, primary targets. So would the shopping centers. So would the places that anybody would go, like a football stadium or a basketball stadium. But none of that is happening. So instead, they're ramping up this kind of fear so that Americans continue to shake in their boots, at the same time trying to keep the U.S. currency as the reserve currency for the world and let the IMF continue to become more and more powerful around the world. And there's beginning to be a pushback on that. So I'm starting to see some connections here that I never saw before. And I'm not exactly sure of myself. I'm trying to read more and more about the connections between the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency and what's going on with the military and the connection between the U.S. borrowing in order to prop up their military. There's a lot of stuff that's going on that I'm just now becoming privy to, and it has a lot to do with the IMF and the World Court as well. And the EU and China and Brazil and other countries are starting to give a pushback on this. They're starting to trade in their own currencies. And I think that scares the hell out of the American elites because it really gets in the way of their profitability. So I don't know if you've been reading any about these connections, but I'm somewhat of a neophyte to this. But the more I read, the more I'm seeing that there's connections between the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency and the military operations that we're engaging in, holding people in fear, taking military actions against all other countries in order to batter down any walls that would get in the way of having an American dollar continue to be triumphant in the world.
Oh, I have followed it, Bob, and I've written about it and had some other guests discussed it with them on past programs. There's no question that the supremacy of the dollar has been very key for this country, in not only in bolstering the economy and in funding our militarism. We're support for the dollar, foreign nations recycling back into the U.S. dollar. The hegemony of the dollar has been very, very central. And as you importantly point out, that is beginning to, there are cracks in that facade. There's no question about it. Our countries, China and Russia, recently agreed to trade, I believe, I'm not certain if it's exclusive, but I think at least predominantly in their own currencies, getting away from the dollar. To me, that's a first step toward eliminating the dollar entirely. Other countries are doing the same thing. Brazil is involved a little bit of this, and there are other countries, and it'll be one after another, and the dollar will be weakened. You know, Project Census, a top story over the past year, was the weakening of the dollar and perhaps replacing it with another currency or a global currency, but the dollar definitely is weakened. The only alternative we have right now, which has been going on, so-called quantitative easing, where the Fed just cranks up the printing press and goes to town, just prints as much as they want. So China is buying less of our treasury securities. I'm not certain about Japan. They're basically a U.S. colony as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think Japan is actually with us on this.
Oh, I think Japan is with us.
The dollar.
Absolutely. I mean, we occupy their country. We've got bases all over the bloody place. So, I don't know why Japan thinks they need us for security. Japan has a decent military. China doesn't threaten Japan, claiming that's a possibility. I mean, they're thinking back to the 1930s and 1940s. We're talking about 2010. China threatens no country now, but China wants no country to threaten them, including economically. And it would be wonderful wonderful, I think, if the dollar lost its top position and we had maybe regional currencies. Why should one currency be the king of the hill? Why not currencies having their own hegemony, certainly in their own countries and in their own regions? So you have a group of currencies that are competing with one another, but the Fed is compensating for that. China might buy billions less in treasury securities, so the Fed just prints up that amount and pumps it into the economy. It goes to the banks. They use it for speculation. I guess it can also go to fund militarism. So, I mean, our military campaign, Bob, has not been impeded so far, but I just wrote an article that quoted a Pentagon study and quoted another study by the conservative Center for International and Strategic Studies, a very well thought of a think tank among conservatives. And they conclude that the Pentagon was a little more measured in what they had to say. But basically they said, without really saying it, that they really haven't accomplished anything since 2001 in Afghanistan. Things are still very unstable. They really can't say they've won anything. And the guy who wrote the CSIS study, he said in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've accomplished absolutely nothing, except in Afghanistan, it's worse than Iraq. And unless policy changes, he didn't say it, but he implied it, this thing is heading for a train wreck down the line. The policy is absolutely not working. It has to be changed. We've been on this, my God, Afghanistan since October 2001, Iraq since March 2003. If the policy has failed, which is basically what this guy is saying, you've got to change the policy. So what do? We change commanders.
Yeah,
they have the
right.
Same policy.
Right. And in the meantime, ramp up that same policy with drone strikes in not only Pakistan, but Yemen and Somalia, and we continue on that same train and speed it up.
So oh, absolutely.
When it crashes, it'll be really a crash.
Can I make one other point, too, because you raise a very important thing, which I think needs to be stressed. Since 9/11, over 9 years ago, there has not been one single terror attack on U.S. soil. The supposed one cited that we supposedly foiled, and I emphasize again, they were all fake. They were all contrived to incite fear. Forget about those. Forget about the headlines. There has not been one terror plot against any target in the U.S. And, Bob, in 9 years, if bad guys wanted to get us, you could be darn sure there would have been at least a few of them. Bombs going off in cities, people killed. There hasn't been one. So what does that say? Terrorists threatening us? There are no. The only terrorists threatening us are the people running the government in Washington. They're the terrorists we need to worry about.
Well, that leads us right into the double dose of terrorism that the American people are getting from this current administration. Which, and one of the two things I have in mind in responding to what you were saying was the continuity of government. Policy that began really back during the Ronald Reagan years, that this idea of if the terror gets ramped up to a sufficient level, we can suspend the Constitution and let the military take over. That process didn't die with Reagan. That continues on today. And it all really started with an executive order in 1988 from Reagan that says we're going to do this so that if there's any threat to the United States government, we can suspend the Constitution and let the military run the show. Now, if you take that continuity of government thing, the idea of we're in a constant state of emergency, and now the emergency has reached a particular point where, hey, folks, stay in your houses, martial law, we're going to just take over and let the government go from this, let the military take over from this. Now, tie that to Obama's great commission, debt commission, deficit commission that he had established, the 14-vote commission with, mm-hmm. like, three liberals on it. And then you look at what it is that they say that they want to do to get us out of the problem that we're in, the debt problem. So what are we going to do? Reduce the cost of living increases for Social Security, raise the retirement age to 69, end mortgage interest deduction, end tax deduction for employers providing health insurance, cut the top tax rate for the rich, and in the meantime, bring people deeper into poverty and connect that poverty to a deepening sense of fear about how everybody else is after them, and then you can bring in the military and you can get absolute power. And I don't want to sound like a conspiracy nut, but it looks to me like it's not a conspiracy, but all these forces and all these varying parts of our social, economic, governmental structure are kind of gelling together in this kind of institutional movement toward complete authority.
Oh,
I gave a talk at Berkeley a couple of weeks ago. Oh, go ahead, I'll let you in here.
There's no doubt about what you say, Bob. I think our goal overseas, it's total global hegemony by the iron fist of the military, or simply cowing individual countries to bow to our will. And at home, it's well, Obama said it. Obama gave a talk about a year ago, touting the need for austerity because of this terrible deficit that we have. So I think, as you say, they want to cut vital services like Social Security. Medicare has already been slashed. They want to do more. I think they want to get rid of Medicaid, too. I think they want to get rid of all three down the line, but you have to be clever about it. And I think they want to get rid of all social benefits, literally to turn the U.S. into a third world country, repressed by shock troops, whether it's the U.S. military or local police or whatever, militaristically enforced, because people will be very angry when they realize that vital things that they've been counting on or have had will be disappearing on the pretext that we have a deficit problem and we need to fix it. Well, we do have a deficit problem, and fixing it is easy as pie. If I were a dictator, Bob, oh, I would be a benevolent one, I guarantee you that. If I were not a George Bush dictator or an Obama dictator, if I were a dictator, I'm no economist, I'm no super genius, and yet fixing the deficit is a piece of cake. A piece of cake, provided I could enforce my policies and nobody could say boo about them. Number one. I mean, the easiest one of all, Bob, slash the military budget drastically, close every single base overseas, cut. We don't have an enemy in the world, and we haven't had an enemy since the Japanese surrendered in August 1945. The only enemies we have are the ones that we created. There are no enemies. What country, no matter how despotic their leader, would ever imagine attacking the U.S.? My God, I mean, we could wipe them out in less than 24 hours. We can literally level the country, no matter what it is. Well, maybe not China or Russia in a day, but we could destroy the country with the greatest of ease. No country would ever dream of attacking us. So we're not threatened. We need to get rid of that grotesque military. Just cut it down to size. Minimally in half. Ideally, a lot more. And close every single one of the overseas bases. End the illegal foreign imperial wars. End our threatening other nations. That alone would fix the deficit. We need to increase Social Security. We need to increase Medicare. We need to increase Medicaid, not slash it. We need social benefits. We need to bolster public education, not destroy it, which is what Obama wants to do, like Bush. I mean, we could afford all of these things and cut the deficit at the same time if we did responsible things, instead of continuing to transfer wealth to the rich, Bob. What the deficit cutting scheme is all about is transferring maximum wealth from the great majority to the super rich. That's what it's all about.
And it's been going on for, actually, it really got its start in the 1970s. It's been going on for a long time. If you look at the richest, let's say 400 taxpayers of the 1960s, I'm getting this from a book called Winner Take All Politics. The richest people in the 1960s had a tax rate of around 40%, give or take. I've seen a couple of different surveys that say a little bit different in numbers. But by the 1990s, that was down to 30%, and then by 2007, it was 16%. Now, just by those tax cuts alone, you have a tremendous upward shift of money going from the very, very rich out of the pockets of the few that are struggling to keep the money together. Now, if you add to that the state intervention in the market system that's been going on forever, so that whenever these neoliberal bubbles explode, or whenever the neoliberals get into trouble because they've overdone it in terms of their greed, then the government steps in and puts price controls in or whatever market adjustments need to be made so that those can continue, the wealthy can continue to reap the profits of their wealth. I started waking up to this originally when NAFTA was the big thing in the 1990s, and then when the World Trade Organization came about in the 1990s. And then what happens, it seemed to me, and I'm going to go back to Karl Marx for this, I think he was right, when you get this particular economic elite who find that they have a need to manipulate the government so they can continue their profit-making, it's done under the auspices of neoliberalism, that's what we call it today, or getting the government off the backs of the people, when the people are really the economic elites. And so you have a breaking down of the government so that the elites can continue to make money, and then they use the military to support that continued intervention in other countries. And here's the thing that really kind of alarms me about all of this, Steve. It can't be long before a government that's willing to terrorize and murder the enemy other becomes willing to do it to their own citizens. And we've seen this already with Obama claiming the executive privilege of assassinating U.S. citizens. So when power becomes the goal and citizen passivity becomes the means to that goal, there's no ethical bar from obtaining that end. It's just all a matter of institutional manipulation and reasoning to get to that particular end. And that's what we're seeing, and that's what kind of really frightens me now about the state of America, not just economically, but economically and combined with that power of terrorizing the citizens to keep them passive. I did a talk in Berkeley a couple of weeks ago, and I made the case that American democracy is an authoritarian democracy. In other words, it's very close to totalitarian democracy, but only in the sense that we use a whole lot of propaganda at home and use a lot of force abroad. I think I'd like to correct that now. As I start listening to Obama more and more and seeing where this is going, I think we're becoming a totalitarian democracy or totalitarian government here. And I think we're seeing a very strong threat to that economically and militarily as they begin to turn all of that against the citizens to keep them passive.
There is no question that what you just said is absolutely true. And I wrote in the past week or so about Chalmers Johnson, who died on November 20th, and quoted him long ago. I had him on my program, tried to get him back. I didn't realize that his health was so poor. It really was poor. The last 10 weeks of his life, he was in at-home hospice care. He really wasn't able to do much of anything. It was just a matter of time before he'd go. But in his writing, his books and some articles, and he's been on the militaristic issue for so long, and he used to be a consultant back in the 1960s, I think early 1970s, to the CIA.
He was a CIA guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, a consultant. He called himself a former Cold Warrior. And he believed that the Soviet Union was a real threat, saying that he still believes they were a real threat. I disagree with him on that. Way back when, I guess I believed it years ago. But when I became awakened to what really is going on, I came to the conclusion that the Soviet Union was threatening nobody, but we sure were threatening them. But a strong point that he kept hammering at was that the path that the U.S. is on is a path toward tyranny and ruin. I mean, we're wrecking the country economically because we're spending ourselves into the ground because of this horrendous militarism, and we're enforcing it by increasing homeland tyranny, and he sees that as the outcome. I'll have a guest in mid-December, on the 16th of December, Bob, Emmanuel Wallerstein, who sees the present system disappearing over, I think, a fairly long period. I'll get his latest thoughts on it when he comes on air. He's been on this issue. He studies world systems, and he believes that the system that we live under today is doomed to disappear. And he says he doesn't know what will replace it. He sees it as one of two choices. It will either be something more egalitarian or something much harsher. There's no question that the path we're on right now is heading for the much harsher. And based on what you're talking about, Bob, and what I write about all the time, I simply can't imagine an egalitarian outcome unless there's a public uprising that absolutely forces it or demands it. and brings change about from the grassroots. But the politicians do not have anything egalitarian in mind for us.
Yeah, I wouldn't count on the populist uprising yet because, I mean, you see it in France, you've seen it in Greece, but they're much more democratic in their mindset. I don't think the American people are really that democratic in their mindset. I think that one of the things that certainly shows itself about this is regarding voter turnout for elections. It's always low, and it keeps getting lower. And all the young people that supported Obama, including my students whom I talk to about this all the time, they're so disillusioned with government. They're so disenchanted with it. And even when I go to a social event, and even people who aren't in academics, they're so disenchanted with the government, they don't even want to hear about it. So it's just this kind of roiling anger under there. And the people that do turn out are the people like the Tea Partiers and the people who are really upset, and they don't know what else to do. And so they turn to their elections, and all they do is vote out the oligarchs that are in so they can put other oligarchs back into place again. And so we've hit a very dangerous point in our democracy where we're turning out oligarchs every 2 years. I think this is going to happen. I think this is what the 2008 election showed us. Turn out some of the oligarchs and put some other oligarchs in, and then when they're not doing our bidding, we turn them out and put some other ones in. But I don't see a large mass waking up to what's going on in the big picture. And I think that's what your show provides, the big picture of things that people need to put together. You know, Arianna Huffington has a great book out, Third World America, talking about where we're headed and where we kind of already are. And my response to that is that it's good stuff and it's really well researched. But if you really want to see where America's headed, all you have to do is look at Iraq and what we've done in Iraq. I mean, the Iraqi education system has been totally destroyed, with academics being murdered left and right, and the Iraqi journalists being murdered as well. You know, there is no Iraqi middle class anymore. They've destroyed the Iraqi state, and all of that, WikiLeaks has thrown in there as well. They've done ethnic cleansing. All this stuff that has happened in Iraq could easily take place here with the direction that we're going. I just want to say that, with the direction we're going. I don't see it's a necessity that happens, but we're certainly headed in something like that, a collapse of the state and a use of the military to control the mechanisms of the state. At a talk I was at Berkeley this past week, not mine, a different one, the speaker talked about his own experiences with the police state in California, where they've got these drunk driving stops. I don't know exactly what you call them legally, where they came at him, and he's an older man, and with his father, they came at him, and the cops were very belligerent and very demanding, show us your license, and where have you been, and all this kind of stuff. And that's the first steps of this. And I don't see a large populace waking up to this and saying, okay, we're going to put a stop to this right now, and we're going to put the fear in the politicians by putting a stop to this, by taking to the streets. The only person that's been able to put the fear in the politicians is Julian Assange.
Well, you're right, Bob, and I moan about this all the time, that there are too many people in this country that aren't paying attention, that are more concerned with the trivia going on around them, whether it be sports or films or shopping or whatever. And to me, that is absolutely insanity. They're committing a death sentence by not getting involved. I think what might arouse people in this country is if things get bad enough, that enough people aren't certain where their next meal is coming from. If they can't feed their kids, maybe that will finally light a stick of dynamite under them. But you're right. We have a comatose public. They simply don't realize opting out of the political process is not the answer. I agree. Voting for a Democrat or Republican is throwing your vote away. I haven't voted for either party in many, many years, and I never will again. We need independent candidates, we need new issues, we need an entirely new system, but sitting on our hands doing nothing will not make it happen. The only way, I say this on this program all the time, Bob, the only way we'll ever see constructive change is if we, at the grassroots, force the politicians to give us what they absolutely don't want to do, but won't be able to deny us with enough pressure put on them. Let's take a short break, Bob, and we'll come right back and pick up on this or wherever else you want to go.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, and I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions. Or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Adam Kolker from the Brooklyn Jazz Underground. We're going to be hosting a weekly show every Tuesday at 5 p.m., focusing on sounds coming from the borough of Brooklyn. We'll be playing some new releases, doing live interviews, some live performances, maybe even venture out into music from some of the outer boroughs. Brooklyn Jazz Underground, Tuesday at 5, only on the Progressive Radio Network.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back on with Bob Abele. Oh, this has been a great discussion, Bob, starting off with WikiLeaks, and so many things relate to that, and all the many, many strands, such important topics. Last year, by the way, I did a year-end Obama Year One review, and I simply called it Obama Year One, Betrayal and Failure. I decided, I wasn't sure if I wanted to do a year two, but then I decided I'd do it, and I call it Obama Year Two. I'm working on it. It's a work in progress, and I'll probably get it out sometime after mid-month, a little bit close to the end of the year. But the one last year got very long, and I did it in two parts. This one is getting very long as well, so I think I'll have to split it in two parts, and nobody will read the damn thing. And even the two parts will not be short because there's so much to talk about. And I made a list of things, potential topics to go into. And I said, oh, my God, I mean, I may have to write 5 articles on this, but I'll cover it as best I can, and I'll try to cover the ground without getting too detailed. Otherwise, it will be much more than anybody would go through. But the article this year is called Obama Year 2, Continuing Betrayal and Failure, and indeed it is. Instead of getting better, it gets worse. And I just can't imagine what's upcoming, what's planned to be upcoming in year 3 and 4. You remember back in 1994, Bob, when Clinton took a beating in the off year elections, and Republicans, I think if they controlled the Senate, I think they took control of the House. Anyway, I mean, a lot of Republicans supplanted Democrats. So what did Clinton do in the first year or two? He supported his version of health care reform, which was an abomination, but it was something that a lot of the big providers were not too happy with, especially the drug companies. Well, that went by the boards, and Clinton simply got more conservative. I mean, he came in being a neoliberal, but then he became a hardened neoliberal, and he used the term triangulation and this Democrat leadership. Democratic Leadership Council, which is really just a Republican operation. I mean, they're hardline, they're militaristic. They match the Republicans blow for blow on the absolute worst hardline policies. So that's what Clinton adopted. Well, Obama has already gone that route, but I fear that he will go that route even more than he has already. So we have his deficit-cutting plan. He endorses it completely, by the way, even though it didn't get enough votes in the commission to guarantee a vote in Congress. But I think the die is cast, and this thing is going to get to the floor of the Congress, and if not all of the measures they proposed will be, if not all of them get adopted, I think some pretty mean and nasty ones will. And when there are liberals, like a senator from my state, Bob, Dick Durbin, a so-called liberal, endorses Obama's deficit-cutting plan, I mean that shows you what we're up against. So this coming. There's no end to militarism. There'll be more repression at home. There'll be more repressive laws if there need be. I mean, we have enough on the books right now, and I see some mean and nasty 2 years ahead.
You know, I agree with you on that, and there's a whole host of reasons behind that, and also some consequences of that as well. You were talking about Obama Year 2, and I was kind of chuckling under my breath. I was thinking facetiously, if you want Obama Year 2, all you have to do is photocopy what you did from Year 1 and ramp it up a little bit. But it's even worse than Year 1, I think, because Obama has become, if he wasn't already there, I think that he was already part of being a corporate cat or a corporate politician, but he's now clearly entrenched there. And there's this, we don't live in a democracy anymore. We live in an oligarchy, or I call it authoritarianism, but I'd push it even further these days. And it really wraps around a couple of different things: absolute government power and the definition of corporations as persons. And so when you get corporations as persons and you get all the constitutional references to persons, well, then you've got simply corporations running the show. It's technically and literally what a fascist regime is all about. So the movement away from personhood of our own federal convention with James Madison and John Jay and all of them to the 19th century, by the end of the 19th century, suddenly persons weren't persons anymore. They were partnerships and associated groups and things like that. And then in February 2010, the Citizens United ruling that corporations have all the rights of free speech that individual persons do, that's the last step. That's the last thing that was needed to get all the bricks in place to keep the people out of the government and have the corporate interests run the government. And now they're in a position where they can turn that against the people in a multitude of different ways. I think we left at the break when I was talking about one of my friends who was a speaker at Berkeley, talking about his encounter with the police just at a drunk stop, you know, I don't know what you call them, but that's a form of state terrorism. Direct attacks on non-combatants, innocent non-combatants, for political purposes, and making that the position of state power. Now, you can carry that over into the stuff that's been going on with FBI wiretapping and unwarranted wiretapping, internet wiretapping. I was reading last week a couple of very interesting articles on the new push that the FBI has to take all the information that's being done on the internet. And the bigger your file, the more information they want to look at and see. And all of the technical devices that they have come up with that grab that information and break it down and put it into files. And they've even got keystroke files now, so that as you're typing an email or typing a web domain address, the information gets, for every keystroke, gets downloaded and transmitted into government files. And just 2 weeks ago, the FBI chief, Robert Mueller, was in Silicon Valley out this way to meet with the top executives of Google and Facebook to push them to put backdoor providers of information spying into their systems so that the government could watch what everybody was doing. So you get all of these things put together, and you've got a very precarious state of affairs going on, and Obama is right behind that. So I want to come back to this and ask this. We ran out of time in the last segment. You have very ordinarily liberal commentators who yet continue to bark out, gotta support Obama, gotta support Obama, he's gonna turn around, give him a second term and he'll turn around. And the one person I have in mind, and I don't know if you have the time to do this, I know you're incredibly busy, but do you ever have the opportunity to read or listen to Tom Hartman's program from in Oregon? He's one of the big ones. And I'd like to just ask you, where does this come from, this idea of let's give him a second term, and when he gets in the second term, everything will be fine?
Oh, I am 100% opposed to that. I remember having heard Tom Hartman some time back. I have not listened to him in years. Once I got busy writing, I just don't have time, Bob. But he actually supports a second term for Obama?
He supports it on a number of different grounds. I tried to call into his show a couple of times to talk to him about this, but other people do it. He kind of cuts them off and then continues to lecture on this. Two things. Number one, if you vote any other way, then you ensure that a more right-wing Republican gets into office. And number two, there could be two openings on the Supreme Court, and you certainly don't want any conservative in office to put up the justices for the Supreme Court. Those are his two main arguments. But I think that one of the things that progressives have to do is kind of get on the same in the same playbook here. You can't have progressives being split between saying, let's keep putting Obama in and keep giving him our vote of support, and let's give him one more term and everything will turn around fine when he doesn't, when he knows he can't be reelected. I think there's absolutely no evidence for that at all. And the Supreme Court thing, I get. I do understand that. You certainly don't want, you know, a Sarah Palin in office making appointments to the Supreme Court. But I also think that we need some help now, and you're not going to get that out of Mr. Obama. So
well,
I wanted to kind of get your take on that.
Oh, Steve. Well, as far as the Supreme Court goes, I haven't written a lot about the court, but I've written a little bit, and the appointment that just appalled me and appalled a distinguished law professor I know, Francis Boyle, on the appointment of Elena Kagan. Elena Kagan is as hard right as anyone else on that court. It was an outrageous appointment, an absolutely outrageous appointment. But I would say this for all the other justices: there is no such a thing as a left of center Supreme Court justice. They are all right wing, just that some are more right wing than others. But they are all right wing. They support basically right wing state policies, and to believe otherwise is very foolish. So the difference between having a Democrat in the White House or having a Republican in the White House, for me, it's a matter of splitting hairs. As far as policies overall go, Bob, I just can't imagine a Republican being much more hardline than Obama. And in the first article I did on the year one review last year, I went back to his time in the U.S. Senate, and I went over his voting record. If you struck off the name Obama and just saw what he voted for, it was Republican right down the line, supporting all the big corporate interests. The Iraq War wasn't on at that time. He came into the Senate after the Iraq War started, but I believe he supported the military appropriations. I mean, he was pretty hard right in his voting record, so he did not surprise me one bit on what I knew we were getting once he was elected president. And I was appalled that even very intelligent people, some I know, were just cheering the idea that we finally had a different kind of president. Well, I hope that he might be a little bit better than George Bush, but as far as I'm concerned, he's turned out worse than George Bush, the main reason being that he, a Democrat, fooling a lot of people, his supporters, was able to get through policies that no Republican could ever do, just like Nixon was the one to go to China. Well, Obama was the one to get a financial reform, which is no reform at all. It institutionalizes bigness and speculation and all the worst of the abuses that caused the economic crisis that we're in right now for Main Street, so-called health care reform that simply hands the system to let the big providers prey on us and give us as little as possible and charge as much as they want. And he was able to do that. Bush would not have been able to do that. And the game that goes on all the time, Republicans beating up on Democrats, much more than Democrats ever do on Republicans, this is all politics. It's got nothing to do with policy. It's all politics because Republicans want to be the senior partner, and they're very happy having the Democrats as junior partner. The Democrats don't fight back as hard. So right now they're senior partner, but I honest to God, Bob, don't see much of a difference whether one is in office or another in office. Think of Afghanistan as far as war goes. Since Obama came into office, he doubled the U.S. force contingent over there in a losing cause, a quagmire, and they know it. They know it in the Pentagon. They know it in the White House. They know it in the Congress. And the idea isn't to win this war. It's to keep fighting it, because of the hundreds of billions of dollars that go into the pockets of the corporate interests, not just the defense contractors, but all the other companies, the technology companies, all the companies that profiteer on war, including private military contractors, many tens of thousands of them. I mean, this is big business for these people. You stop these wars, and you put these people out of business. So they want to keep this thing going.
Sure. Just look at who Obama took with him to Pakistan. 250 business executives, primary among them were the military contractors that took like $15 billion in contracts while they were there with the Pakistani government. And that's what he was going there for, selling those weapons, giving profit back to the people who are putting up his campaign money, and not really doing much but keeping their businesses going by continuing to declare war and continuing to do strikes here and there, and all in the name of terrorism. And you're right about the Obama voting record. I was actually looking for that yesterday online, and actually it sounds like you might have it all pulled together. He was very much a Republican in his voting style. And regarding the war, he was never critical of the war, even as a congressman, that it shouldn't have been or was a violation of international law or was unethical. He was critical of the war because he thought it would be unwinnable and it wasn't being conducted in the proper way. His concern was not with the legality or the ethics of the war. His concern was, can we actually do something here? And I don't think it's being run right, which is exactly what American discourse about wars have been reduced to since the Bush years. Can we win, and are we conducting it properly in terms of this winnability issue? It's not about, is this the right thing to do? Is this good for everybody, or is this just good for a few? That's off the table. And the idea that this is opposed to international law, the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq, that the UN is opposed to it, and overwhelmingly they were going to not vote for the United States' permission to invade Iraq, that's all off the table. You can't discuss that. There's two doctrines that you're not supposed to discuss in America. Number one is our unlimited right to go to war with whomever we want. And number two, the idea of a neoliberal state that big business is what is good for America. You just can't challenge that. Obama learned that early on in his career, if he didn't already have that as his own mythology, and he runs from it. And that's where he governs from. And so I don't get the Tom Hartman thing saying, give him more time, give him another chance. He's not going to get any different because he is on that side, and that's why he was given all the corporate money to do what it is that he's doing.
Well, there's no question about that, Bob. Tom Hartman, for whatever good he does, he is all wet on Obama. Nation Magazine is my favorite target in supporting Democrats through thick or thin. Nation Magazine is supposedly liberal publication. I once subscribed to it. When they endorsed the Afghan war back in 2001, I canceled my subscription. And I've never looked back, and now I consider them a hideous operation. Nobody should read the Nation magazine. If any listeners subscribe, cancel your subscription. They don't support the rule of law. They don't support justice. They don't support equity and social benefits for the main people in the country, especially people in need. They support Democrats thick or thin, no matter how bad their policies. But there are others as well. The on-air target I like to go at. Not too often, but I've done it a couple of times. Keith Olbermann, who literally runs his program as a promotion to Democrats and Democrat policies. I mean, during the healthcare debate, every night he was like a commercial for Obama's healthcare program, which is an abomination, and he was supporting it. And on and on and on and on. So as he's the opposite. He's the other bookend of Fox News. Fox News is a commercial for Republicans, and Olbermann, and I guess MSNBC, maybe to a large extent, is a commercial for Democrats. But for me, they're the same.
Yeah, they're the same. And you can't get funded if you don't do that. I mean, the programs that would really bring in third-party views, such as yours and other programs, have very limited funding, and the corporations certainly aren't going to go there. I remember during the California campaign for governor during this last election, it was Jerry Brown and Meg Whitman, and the third-party candidate was not even mentioned in the media, any of the media, aside from the small alternative media. And even when the Green Party candidate tried with a legitimate ticket to get into the last of the governor's debates, they arrested her and they took her and put her in jail during the debate and then released her after the debate was over. She had a ticket to get in. This is corporate America. It's two little tiny differences in a big wide spectrum, but those two little tiny differences called Democrat and Republican belong way over in the right, both of them in corporate pockets. That's why Tom Hartman goes the way he does. That's why the Nation goes the way that he does. Or they do. I canceled my subscription to The Nation a couple years ago for the same reason you did, Steve. And so we just have to go to local, smaller, more progressive, and wake up. And to that end, if you don't mind, I'd like to end with a couple of comments. You had asked about the encyclopedia articles. They are specifically addressed to these kind of issues, but they're kind of structural issues, like what is torture and how does torture work and what are the international laws on torture, things of that nature. They give people basis and ammunition that they can construct and define and develop their views on these things. And that's the Encyclopedia of Global Justice that's coming out in February. Now, how do we end all of this? How do we stop this? I think there are two things generally we need to do, and this is what I'm putting in my next book when it comes out mid-year of next year. Number one, we've got to stop this idea that human beings aren't rational, that we're just emotional, because that's what got us in trouble to begin with, the 1980s whole postmodern movement that says, oh, you know, all you've got is a couple of narratives of your particular culture. No, we're rational creatures. We can think about these things. We can think in terms of principles. We can ask our government, qui bono, who's benefiting from all of this? Where are the inherent values that are being placed in this structure that we call government? And I think the second thing we need to do is look back to our ethical foundations, the recognition of universal principles that humans will embrace. It's not just freedom. It's also equality. The neoliberals have hijacked freedom and run it in an economic direction. But the other way to look at that, our country was also founded on the ethical idea of freedom. Neoliberalism and the current government regime stands for inequality. It stands for a propaganda model that allows this inequality to grow, that allows militarism to grow. If we come back to the notion of equality that has to be the limitation on freedom, we can return back to some semblance of democracy.
Amen, Bob. That was a wonderful way to end the program. If I may, I just want to inform listeners, many may have had other things they were doing last Thanksgiving weekend. I had fresh programming, not repeats, and those who missed them can hear the programs in the archives. One program was with Catherine Hughes on political prisoners. The other was with Professor Denny Rancourt a University of Ottawa professor. It was a wide-ranging discussion, just like you and I have had, Bob, and listeners can go to the archives and hear these programs. I didn't want repeats. I had a repeat on Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, but didn't want repeats, so I prepared the programs in advance, and they're in the archives. They can be listened to. I'll do the same thing over Christmas and New Year's. There will be fresh programming that listeners can access through archives and listen to anytime at all. Bob, this was a terrific discussion. I wish we could continue it. My great thanks for coming on. We will do this again soon. I guarantee you that if you're willing to come on.
Oh, I would love to, Steve. I enjoy talking to you.
Many, many thanks, Bob. And I'll just say tune in tomorrow. Another program just like this one. The kind of program you sure don't get on CNN or Fox. And this is what you get on PRN and what you get on this program all the time. Do make PRN and this program a regular habit.